Guess that's you.
Okay. I have had the opportunity to spend some time with Mark since he got here yesterday, and Mark really did a favor. He did a really great favor for me that some of the other speakers didn't do. He drove in, so I didn't have to go down to the airport and pick him up. I was able to meet him here at the facility, and we've had some quality time since, and I really have gotten to know him, and I can say that I'm looking forward to what he has to say today. Just a little quick background. He's from Navarro, Florida. He says there are beautiful beaches down there, just the most gorgeous white sand beaches that there are. I understand he comes there from via Boston. I think that accounts for the accent that we're going to hear. He has a couple of lovely grandchildren, and I really look forward to hearing his story. And with that, I give you Mark B.
My name is Mark. I'm an alcoholic. Dead giveaway, huh? My sobriety date's April 10th, 1988. My home group is the Miracle Group in Fort Walton Beach, Florida. The Miracle Group is a group that believes in the solution Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer. We usually get together about 6:30 and read the book Alcoholics Anonymous for anywhere from a half hour to 45 minutes to an hour, depending on where we are in the book. And then we break for 10 minutes and greet people at the door, and then we have a meeting that comes out of the book Alcoholics Anonymous for an hour. We have a very active group. We do a lot of service in that area, and the group believes in the solution Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer. We don't allow for burning desires, and I'm extremely grateful for that. In 1968, I had a burning desire in Southeast Asia, and it took 10 shots of penicillin to get rid of it. So I'm extremely, extremely grateful for that. Two o'clock on a Saturday afternoon when the Blue Angels are in town. This is a pretty good deal, man. I'm glad you people decided to show up. I was up in my room with my little dog and doing a little prayer and meditation, and the dog woke me up and told me it was time to get downstairs. So that's why I'm here. My buddy Chris came with me, and Dale, and they're both members of the Miracle Group, and they're stand-up members of Alcoholics Anonymous. They're awake members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm proud to say I'm an awake member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Like I told you, I got here April 10th, 1988, and the reason I'm here tonight is because of the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm here because God got me sober. One of the reasons I love Alcoholics Anonymous so much is because it's given me every single thing I have today. Make no mistake, I didn't get sober because of meetings. I got sober because of God. I came to meetings for a year and a half out of a VA hospital in Northampton, Massachusetts. I came sometimes to three meetings a day, sometimes five meetings a day. See, I heard meetings makers make it, and I just came to them meetings. But what I didn't hear is meeting makers don't make it if they're taking substitutes. So I came here on Percodan, Valium, Xanax, Halcyon, Trazodone, Thurazine, and a touch of Melorol every now and then when I was really down. The VA was trying to sober me up, and you know, I came to meetings and I tried to listen, but I usually dozed off halfway through. And what happened for me is one Monday night, I came to the Monday night East Hampton meeting, and Jean from the Ludlow Group shared her experience, strength, and hope. She talked about being just like me. She talked about being a fearful, lonely alcoholic. And through God's grace, a little bit of willingness coincided with the grace of God, and I'm standing here sober today. Because Jean made no bones about it. She talked about a power greater than herself. See, I didn't believe in God when I got here. Any belief I had in God, I left in Southeast Asia in 1968. So I really identified with Jean. And I didn't identify with the outside stuff. She told her story. She was a housewife that drank wine, that lived in a beautiful home in Ludlow, Massachusetts. I was a homeless ex-con veteran that lived in a VA hospital at the time with nothing in my pocket. What I identified was what I identified with the fear and the grace and the loneliness she had in her life. And I know that was God's gift to me that night. I know that as sure as I'm standing here today. The book Alcoholics Anonymous tells you, first thing I'd like to do is I'd like to thank the committee for asking me to come. I'd like to thank Mick. He's called me, and we've emailed back and forth. I'd like to thank Susan. I'd like to thank my friend Tom and anybody else that has anything to do with this, because I know how hard these are to put on. Me and Chris and a bunch of people do one down in Fort Walton Beach. I'm no longer active in it, but Chris still is. And, you know, a lot of people get involved with it, and by the time it comes around to putting it on, if you get 5, 7, 8 people that are going gangbusters still, you're in pretty good shape. So I know how difficult it is to put on. And I'm going to tell you, I grew up in Quincy, Massachusetts. My father was a Second World War veteran. Landed Omaha Beach D-Day, and I loved my dad. My dad was a drinker. He loved alcohol. I can remember growing up as a kid, and I had all this crazy stuff going on inside me. I had no idea what it was, but I found out sometime later in Alcoholics Anonymous it was fear. You know, I can remember being in a pair of bunk beds. My brother Al slept to the right. My brother Pete slept in the top bunk. I slept in the bottom bunk. And I can remember hearing someone playing the accordion one beautiful sunny morning. I knew it was the accordion because my pop would get drunk and play Dick Cantino records. And I went over to the window and looked out onto the porch, and there was a great big woman. She must have weighed 300 pounds, flowing white negligee, playing the accordion, drinking Smirnoff's vodka. I yelled to my mother, "Ma, there's a big woman on the porch drinking vodka, playing the accordion." She said, "Don't worry about it, Mark. It's your uncle's wife. They're here on their honeymoon." And, you know, I fell in love with that woman. She was a wonderful woman, you know. She would parade through the house, and we'd march behind her, and my dad would throw shoes, and it was just a great upbringing, you know. My brother Pete taught me at an early age that how to take radios out of cars. I thought he was teaching me to be a mechanic when I got older, but my brother Pete had a problem with alcohol, and he took me down to the local car dealership, and I'd take the radios out of cars and give them to him, and he'd sell them and get his booze. And grew up watching Jimmy Cagney and Humphrey Bogart. My brother Pete said, if the police ever come, you know, you just talk out of the side of your mouth, tell them you don't know nothing, you're a young kid, they got to take you home. Well, they came. You go to the same place often enough, they came and grabbed me and brought me to Quincy Police Station. They were sweating me, good guy, bad guy, the whole nine yards, you know, and I was keeping to my story, you know. I want to go home. I miss my mom. Let me go home. Let me go home. And one of the cops got a bright idea. He said, "Hey, you know, you like ice cream, kid?" I said, "I love it." He said, "What do you like?" I said, "A hot fudge sundae with vanilla ice cream and hot fudge. It's really great." He said, "Tell me who put you up to this. I'll get you one." I said, "My brother Pete." Yeah. You might have guessed I was alcoholic back then, you know. A couple of days later, Pete got out of jail, and he likely beat me to death. You know what I mean? And, you know, I get into high school. I was a pretty big kid, so I started playing football. My senior year, I was elected captain of the football team. I was going great guns and, you know, wanted to go on to college. I noticed something, though. You know, I loved football, and I loved playing sports. Tim talked about it last night. But as soon as I picked up that drink at 14 years old, that stuff took the background. See, when I was on the football field, I discovered something wonderful. All that fear and craziness that was going on inside me disappeared. But when I was 14 years old, I discovered alcohol took it away a lot faster. You know, that's why I could identify with Dr. Silkworth when he gave Bill the solution, basically. Well, the problem and then the solution, that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. That's why I drank. I don't know why you drank, but I drank because I loved the effect alcohol gave me. I loved it. I just ran with it. Drank at a place called Kavanaugh Field. You know, Leo knows about Kavanaugh Field. Leo probably had a few fractures out in Kavanaugh. And we drank at a beautiful place out at Squaw Rock. What a great place that was. And I can remember seeing Leo and Fred and a bunch of people. Me and Leo grew up together. So if anybody really wants to know the truth about Leo, because I knew he snuck in here from Massachusetts years ago, come see me after the meeting, I'll tell you. He's a real alcoholic. No doubt. No doubt. All you got to do is look at him, you can tell. But I'll give you a few of the stories if you want them. And you know, that one night we were out there, I had one of my first blackouts, you know, and I wound up fracturing a kid's skull with my crutch. And a short period of time later, I was in front of a judge in the Quincy District Courtroom. There was a war going on in Southeast Asia. The judge told me I could either go to jail or I could volunteer to go in the service. And I wound up going into the service. You know, my senior year when I was playing football, I discovered a wonderful thing. Second to last game, I wound up breaking my leg. And I spent the rest of my senior year with a cast on my left leg in the front room of my home on a bed. And I discovered when you get hurt and people felt sorry for you, they did things that they normally didn't do. And I was to carry that for a lot of years. I can remember being on that bed, the teachers would come over and they would tutor me. And basically all they did was come over and we'd talk about sports or what was going on. Occasionally I read a book or two, and I wound up getting on the honor roll that year. And right through the year they put me on the honor roll, and I don't think I took a test. And what I discovered was when you were hurt or people thought you were hurt and they felt sorry for you, they did a lot of stuff for you. And that came in real handy through my drinking career. You know, fast forward, I wound up going in the Army. The Army recruiter was in the courtroom. The judge offered me either 3 months in that Dedham House of Correction or to go in the military. The Army recruiter was there, so I signed up for the Army. Went to a party 6 weeks later. I went in on what they called the delayed entry program. A bunch of my friends were there. We were drinking that night. I talked 6 of my friends into coming in the military with me. We headed down to Fort Dix, New Jersey together. Some of them guys still got resentments today, but that's okay, you know. Fort Dix, New Jersey, wasn't able to get any alcohol there, but discovered that thing again. When I was physically active, none of that insanity was going on inside me. So right through basic training, physically active. Loved the military. Wound up going down to Fort Belvoir, Virginia, right outside of Washington, D.C. I trained to be a radio operator down there. Great place. Washington, D.C. was right up the road. I go into Washington, D.C., get drunk at night, go back and learn how to operate a radio during the day. My friend at that time, he was my mentor, actually. He was a wonderful, wonderful guy. He taught me about the morning drink. He taught me when you're hungover, you take 4 fingers of Jack Daniels, shoot it down, and it disappears. He had 14 years in the service. He was a PFC, you know. But he was a wonderful, wonderful guy. He had all the stories, you know. And right there, you might have guessed I probably had a problem with alcohol, but I just thought I was having a lot of fun. Wound up going over to Europe. Could have stayed there for 2.5 years. Stationed at Patton Barracks, Heidelberg, Germany. What a beautiful place. You couldn't ask for a more beautiful place in Europe. Right downtown Heidelberg. Traveled all over Europe with a rifle team. I was a radio operator, and we used to go to different shows. I went to Spain, France, Italy. The only reason I know that is because it was on my discharge papers as a blackout drinker. New Year's Eve came along. Downtown Heidelberg, New Year's Eve, in a little Hofbräu downstairs, smoke, drinking peppermint schnapps and these beers, and we were just shooting them down. A fight broke out, I jumped right in the middle of it. I used to love to fight. I was a violent drunk. I don't know what that's all about, but that's what I was about, and I loved to fight. And I can remember being in the middle of the fight, someone yelled MPs, and me and my buddy from San Antonio ran out the back door, ran around front. There was a Jeep parked there, so we jumped in the Jeep and headed back to the barracks. They waved us right through the front gate because the Jeep had a siren and a light on it, and, you know, zoomed right through the front gate. I must have been feeling a little nostalgic because I circled the football field twice and crashed into a goalpost. Needless to say, the company commander called me in the next morning, and again, I'm in trouble because of alcohol. He told me, "Mark, someone saw you last night. You cracked up that Jeep into the goalpost out in the football field. You stole it downtown. You were involved in a fight. I don't know what I'm going to do with you. But I know one thing I can do." He said, "I can give you papers. You can sign them and you can go to Vietnam or you can be court-martialed." Once again, in trouble because of alcohol. Wanted to stay in the military, so I opted for Vietnam. signed the papers, came back to Massachusetts for 2 weeks, saw a childhood sweetheart I was engaged to be married to. I saw her for about an hour. I spent the rest of the time drinking with the guys. Went down to San Antonio, Texas, where my buddy was from. Always wanted to see the Alamo, never made it, you know. Saw the inside of some great bars down in San Antonio. They get sawdust on the floor. What a great place to fight, you know. And it was just it was a good time in my life. Went out to Travis Air Force Base. That's where we shipped to Vietnam from. Put us in great big bunks, rows and rows of double bunks. Told me there was a storm in the Pacific, so they allowed us to go over to the EM Club and have a couple of beers. 4 or 5 hours later, they brought us back in the cattle cars. My uniform was all ripped. Jumped up in my bunk. I forgot to roll the mattress down. Sometime during the middle of the night, the guy in the bottom bunk's kicking me in the butt. I jumped down off the bunk. I said, "What's your problem, man?" He said, "You went to the bathroom all over me, man." I said, "It wasn't me." He said, "You're soaked. I'm soaked, man." I was a little bigger than him, so he saw things my way. A couple of days later, I was in Southeast Asia. I landed in Camlan Bay, grew up Catholic, believed in God, did all the things that a young Catholic boy does, made my confirmation, communion, all those things that a young Catholic boy does. And I wound up in Southeast Asia. I was a radio operator with the first cab in the Central Highlands. A couple of months after I got there, I wound up in a horrible firefight in a valley outside of Anh Ke, Vietnam, and spent 3 days there and watched a lot of people die. Called in artillery because we were being overrun. I wound up calling in artillery, and they basically blew out the whole valley, and a bunch of us survived it. And 4 or 5 days later, they flew us in and pinned some medals on us because it was a very high body count, and I found out there was an orphanage in the village that was included in the body count, and I died in that valley that day. I don't tell you that to feel sorry for me. I don't tell you that for shock value, but what I was taught in Alcoholics Anonymous is my dark past is the greatest possession I have. It can avert misery and death for others. And I've been able to share that stuff ever since I got help with it in Alcoholics Anonymous and outside of Alcoholics Anonymous through psychologists in a VA program. And I've been able to help other men with the same problem and women with the same problem. I suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, and I'm 100% disabled from that through the government. And I've been able to help women that have and other men that have suffered the same thing. And it's a true blessing in my life. It has helped me in ways that I never thought were possible. God has graced me with a way of life today that I never imagined in my wildest dreams. Came out of that valley, and I found out some years later I went into shock and spent the rest of my service time in Southeast Asia on patrols and combat missions and just trying to die. God seemed fit that I wasn't to die, and 15 months later, I was in South Florida visiting my father. My mother and father had gotten divorced, and my father was living in Fort Lauderdale at the time. Second World War veteran. I'm a Vietnam veteran. You get down to visit Pop. What do? You go out and have a few beers. Me and Pop went out and had a few beers. A couple hours later, a few different police departments responded, and I spent the next year of my service time in a psychiatric hospital in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, and what a beautiful place it was. Locked ward, 25 homicidal, 25 suicidal patients. Only the government would put that combination together. And every couple of weeks, what they would do is they'd wake you up in the morning, give you some breakfast, a cup of pills, lunchtime, some lunch, a cup of pills, dinner time, some dinner, a cup of pills. About 10 o'clock, they'd wake you up and give you a sleeping pill. And if I could have stayed there for the rest of my life, I would have been perfectly happy. Every couple of weeks, they take you out to the DAV to bring in a truckload of girls or a busload of girls and have a little dance and a little party, give you a couple of Budweisers, 1,500 milligrams of Thorazine, 3 or 4 Budweisers, trying to do the funky chicken. You know, I was a sight to be seen, you know what I mean? And I couldn't understand why the babes weren't asking me home, you know. And I was dying of an illness I didn't know I had. See, I didn't know the truth. I didn't know the truth about my situation. See, I was alcoholic long before Vietnam, and for the next 20 years, I blamed Vietnam on my alcoholism. I pleaded with judges to send me to VA hospitals. If it wasn't for Vietnam, see, Joanna, look at these medals. If it wasn't for Vietnam, I would have been okay. And that went good for a lot of years. One day they told me I was out of the military. I asked if I could re-enlist. They said no, and I went out to California. 9 months after I landed in California, I was living with a woman. Life seemed to be going pretty good, so I thought my requirements for a relationship was the woman had a beautiful home, a bank account, and a car. And I basically showed up with nothing. And the self-centeredness of my alcoholism is after I got locked up in California, that woman came and bailed me out because I promised to marry her and do the right thing. And I got on a plane and flew back to Massachusetts. You know, if you like me, I hurt you. If you love me, I really hurt you. That's the story of my alcoholism. Got back in Massachusetts, and, you know, I was a homeless Vietnam vet alcoholic that basically drank every day and did whatever he had to do. I was back in Massachusetts about a year, and I wound up in trouble with the law. I wound up being put in the Dedham House of Correction on a very high bail for 5 armed robberies. Me and a bunch of other Vietnam vets traveled around the country robbing drug stores, and sooner or later you get caught for that kind of behavior. And I wound up in the Dedham House of Correction on a very high bail. My brother Pete, that was teaching me how to be an auto mechanic, was up at Walpole State Prison at the time. He had been there for about 10 or 12 years at the time. His auto mechanic business didn't work out too good. And we corresponded back and forth through the grapevine, not the AA grapevine, the jailhouse grapevine. And my brother Pete told me to hold out for the best sentence I could get. And I can remember the public defender coming up to see me and sitting down with me and saying, "Mark, what do you want to do?" I said, "Well, go in and present the facts to the judge. Tell him about the medals I won in Vietnam. Tell him I'd like to go to a VA hospital." The guy almost busted a gut laughing, you know. He nearly fell out of his seat laughing. And he said, "Mark, you're going to prison. It's just a question how long you go to prison for." And the counts called for 25 to life on each one because I had a weapon every time. So I said, "Well, my brother Pete says hold out for the best deal you can make." And he said, "That's my suggestion too." So the day before they were picking trials, he came into me with a big smile on his face and he said, "I got you 10 years. I said, "I'll take it." I wound up going up to the I was in the Dedham House of Correction. I wound up going to Walpole State Prison. See, I was in the Dedham House of Correction. I waited 8 months in there to go to trial. And once again, I was without alcohol and any kind of substitute. And that fear was back. I would be laying in my cell at night. Here I was, a tough Vietnam veteran, that'd be laying in his cell at night, thinking about all the potential I had as a young boy, as a football player who wanted to play professional football, who just wanted to be a decent human being. All the things that I could have done, I'd have tears running down my face, thinking about the different people, thinking about my mom, thinking about my dad, thinking about my brothers and sisters. And then they would open the gates in the morning, I would jump down off my bunk, wipe the tears away, and go out and talk trash like everybody else was. I was just a little kid dying, is what I was. And what happened was I wound up going up to Walpole State Prison. Like I said, my brother Pete had been there for a while, and he wound up sending me down a quarter homebrew, some weed, and some reds, and I was home. The first time I was in, I spent 3.5 years. I got very comfortable there, kind of enjoyed it, I'm afraid to tell you. And, you know, it was a very violent place. I was able to get basically as much alcohol and as much substitutes as I wanted to. I got involved in some things that were illegal there, you might wonder. But, you know, and I lived a pretty good life. I made a parole. I picked up a drink and I went back again. I went back for a year. I made another parole. I picked up a drink and I went back again. I made another parole. I picked up a drink and went back again. It gets kind of repetitious. The second time I was in, I met a couple of guys from the north end of Boston, Joey DeNose and Freddie Fingers, and I went to work for them. There were a couple of stand-up guys, always paid you in cash. They were men of their word. That's one thing about them. And I can remember Joey calling me in. He said, "Mark, you know, we have a problem." I said, "What is it, Joey?" He said, "You drink too much." He said, "We sent you out to do that job last night. You made a mess of things. We asked you to do something, and you do it, but you just make a mess of the things you're supposed to do." And I said, well, I'll cut back. I'll only have a couple of beers. He said, no, Mark, you got to cut back completely. You got to promise that you're not going to drink or else. And I said, well, I'll just have a few. I can't promise I'm not going to drink. No, Mark, you don't understand. You either don't drink and do what we ask you to do, or if we ask you to do something and you mess it up with alcohol again, you're going to wind up with a bullet in the back of your head. So I made my first decision. I took the severance package, you know, and I moved on. And within a short period of time, I was back in prison again. I went back to prison again, and I was released in 1986. Get released from Southeast Correctional Institute in 1986. I was on parole. Where do you go? I went home to live with my mom. My mom took me in. She gave me a place to stay. My mom's a wonderful woman. I have a great relationship with her today because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a great relationship with my dad today because of Alcoholics Anonymous, the program of recovery outlined in the book. And what happened for me was about 3 months after being at my mom's, I had done some things, and I was on my way back to prison, basically, and my brother Pete came down and made a 12-step call on me. My brother Pete got sober in prison. He was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was living up in Northampton. That's where the VA hospital was. My brother Pete and a guy named Kenny came down, and he told me about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he laid out the program of recovery, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has, and he told me how his life had changed. And I saw something different in Pete. He was clear. He was bright-eyed. He didn't shake. He wasn't a madman. He told me about his story, and I knew his story, and he told me how Alcoholics Anonymous had changed him. And the guy named Kenny did the same thing. They made a 12-step call on me. And when my brother Pete got done, he said, do you want to come up to Northampton? I'll get you into the VA hospital, and you can come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, no, Pete, but if you can let me borrow $50, I'd really appreciate it. And you know, my brother Pete gave me that $50 with a tear in his eye, and he said, okay, Mark, do what you have to do, but remember, I'm in Northampton. They have a program up there that can help you. And I wound up on the streets of Boston for the last year of my drinking in Blackstone Park with all the violent antisocial drunks in Boston that were just like me, living in the Pine Street Inn, which is a men's homeless shelter in downtown Boston. And my day consisted of getting up at 5:30 in the morning, going downtown Boston to Hancock, one of the streets downtown, Tremont Street, and stemming money, getting enough money for a bottle of wine, and going to Blackstone Park and drinking wine with the kind of guys that I hung around with. And by 10:30, I was usually asleep. By 1 o'clock, I was usually back up. And then we drank till about 4:30 and went back to the homeless shelter. When I got real sick and shaky, they wound up taking me down to Bridgewater and signing me in for 10 days. Get me to feel better, then took me up to the homeless shelter, and I'd wind up on the streets again. I was dying of an illness I didn't know I had. I did not know I had it. I had been in and out of VA hospitals. I had psychiatrists telling me. I had parole officers telling me. I had priests telling me. I had counselors telling me that I was alcoholic and I needed to get some help, but I was unable to accept that, unable to accept it. And what happened was one night I was at the Pine Street Inn, sitting in the back of the room, full of fear. I had a weapon on me, and I knew someone was going to try to kill me that night. See, what happened for me is alcohol stopped working. I'm extremely grateful for that today. I'm extremely grateful I didn't get to Alcoholics Anonymous before I was supposed to get here. Alcohol stopped working for me that night, and I was sitting there trying to figure out which guy in that room was going to try to kill me. The next morning, I get up and I went and talked to Sheila at the vet center, and I had been talking to Sheila for a year every Wednesday. And that morning, Sheila told me about a program they had for Vietnam veterans up at the Northampton VA hospital and how it had changed some veterans' lives. And that day, she didn't mention alcohol. Every other time I went and saw her, she talked about alcohol. My brother Pete had just made a 12-step call on me a year before when he was living up there. So I said, yeah, that sounds like a good deal for me. I called my brother Pete from there. She put me on a bus in downtown Boston. I get off in Northampton. My brother Pete met me at 5:30 in the morning, took me to breakfast, then took me to his home. He had a beautiful home. He had a painting business. He had a stepwife. He had stepkids. He had a wife and stepchildren. And he had a beautiful life going for himself. He was very happy in Alcoholics Anonymous. He took me up to the VA hospital. I sat in front of a psychiatrist, a psychologist, and a social worker trying to get into that hospital. They wound up getting some of my records from the Jamaica Plain VA hospitals and some other ones. I have records from all over the country, so I used to go into VAs and hide out for a while. And they wound up looking at my records, and the psychologist just shook his head. The social worker went, and the psychologist allowed me to come into the hospital. I spent my first 2.5 years, I spent 4 years in that psychiatric hospital, coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. They put me in a lock ward, 25 people that were just gone. And they locked the door, and I was on that ward. My brother Pete started coming up to see me. And he went in and he talked to the social worker. Then he talked to the psychiatrist and told him about his life and told him what Alcoholics Anonymous had done for him and told him he would like to take me to meetings. And I came to meetings for a year and a half like I talked about in the beginning. I came to meetings on all them different medications. Thank God nobody said, hey, Mark, get out of here. You can't take that kind of stuff. Because I had to come here till I didn't have to take it anymore. And that was Gene's message to me that night. Because, see, Gene was like me. Gene came to Alcoholics Anonymous taking those substitutes till she didn't have to take them anymore. And it was the grace of God, April 10th, 1988, after leaving High Watch Farm. High Watch Farm is the farm mentioned in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It was started by Bill Wilson and Marty Mann and a bunch of people in early Alcoholics Anonymous. I went down there to get over my depression, so I thought I had. And I went down to High Watch, and I was down there for a weekend. I went in on a Thursday. Saturday night, I was doing so well down there, they asked me to chair the Saturday night meeting. And I got up and chaired the meeting. After the meeting, I walked outside and I pissed all over the wall. Tom called me in Sunday morning. He said, Mark, we have a problem. I said, what is it? He said, last night after you chaired the meeting, you went out and went to the bathroom on the wall. I said, oh, yeah, it's that Vietnam injury, Tom. It was a bad one. He said, no, Mark, we did a room search. I said, yeah, what'd you come up with, Tom? He said, we found a bottle of Percodan and some Valium. I said, they're not mine, Tom. He said, Mark, your name's on the bottle. Come on, I know you're delusional, buddy, but come on, will you? He confronted me again. That was Sunday night. Monday night, I went to the Monday night East Hampton meeting, and Jane shared her experience, strength, and hope. Thank God for speaker meetings. Thank God for the message of Alcoholics Anonymous that Gene carried to me that night. I believe God spoke through here like I'm trying to do today. I don't have no fit script. I don't come up here. I'm no great speaker. I know there's new people here. I don't get paid to do this. I just come here to share my experience, strength, and hope because I'm a blessed member of Alcoholics Anonymous. God graced me with sobriety. Donnie took me into the book, and he asked me to do one thing, pay back the gift that I was given. And that's why I'm here today. I spent an hour up in my room praying and meditating, not going over any notes, and asking God to speak through me. And what happened for me was when Gene shared that message, I went back to the VA. I told the doctor I didn't want any more pills. No more pills for me. He said, oh, but you're going to be. And I said, I don't want no more. I spent a couple of days sick. I went to the Wednesday night step meeting. I said, Donnie, I need a sponsor, man. Donnie's a guy I've been listening to for a year and a half. And every time Donnie got done sharing in the meeting, he'd look over at me, and he'd say, remember, God loves you. And I used to want to kill him. And I ran to Donnie. I said, Donnie, I need a sponsor. I'm dying. He said, I know you are, Mark. And he said, what I'll do for you is what my sponsor did for me. We'll open the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll read it to you. Where there's a step, we'll take the step. Where there's an action, we'll take the action. And that was the beginning of the journey for me, April 10th, 1988. Donnie did. He opened that book, and we read. And I found out that I had to fully concede to my innermost self that I was alcoholic, the first step in recovery. And that happened for me April 10th, 1988, through God's grace. See, I learned. I learned that I had to fully concede to my innermost self. I look back at my drinking history. I look back at my year and a half in Alcoholics Anonymous trying to get this thing down, and I saw that I needed a power greater than myself to get sober. I was unable to do it. Self-knowledge availed me nothing. I had a tremendous amount of self-knowledge, but I was unable to stop drinking and taking substitutes. Donnie got me involved very early on. Like I told you, the first 4 years of my sobriety, I spent in and out of a psychiatric hospital. He told me, you go from that ward and you go over to the alcohol ward every day, and you ask those guys if they need anything down at the store, and you go down the store and get it for them and bring their money back to them and their product back to them. And what I used to do is I'd go over the alcohol ward every day, say anybody needs cigarettes or candy or anything, and I'd write it down. Joe, $2. A package of Marlboros and a candy bar. Steve, 2 candy bars, $1.50. And that guy used to hate to see me coming to the store because I would write out all this stuff and then write down how much change I had to give him, and I'd bring their change back to them and give them their stuff, and they would thank me. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. See, Donnie became my sponsor. But there were some conditions on Donnie becoming my sponsor. Donnie looked at me and he said, Mark, I'm going to ask you to do some things. And I said, okay, what is it, Donnie? He said, well, are you alcoholic? And I said, yeah, Donnie, I'm alcoholic. I'm dying. I'm alcoholic to the core. And he says, I believe you are. He said, I'm going to ask you to get on your knees every morning, ask a power greater than yourself for help, and thank that power every night. See, Donnie knew I was incapable of asking God for help. All he told me to do was ask a power greater than myself. He told me, I want you to go to a meeting every day. You can get off that one. I want you in a meeting every day, and I want you talking to members of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, Mark, most importantly in your case, though, I want you to keep your mouth shut in meetings. He said, I've heard you share in meetings, Mark, and I don't want you spreading your illness anymore. And I was extremely grateful for that bit of information because that freed me up to listen in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what it did. And I know Donnie was very wise in that because it freed me up to listen. And when it came to me, I just say, I'm Mark, I'm an alcoholic. My sponsor told me to keep my mouth shut. And people would giggle, and I just say, and that's how it was, man. That's how it was. And what he did, slowly, he led me into the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I joined the Sunday Night Haydenville group. My wife was a member of that group. At the time, she was a friend of my brother Pete's. My wife is in South Florida today speaking. She's going to be telling a story tomorrow morning down at South Florida at a women's conference down there. Her name's DeHolte. She's a Cherokee Indian, and she's a bright spot of my life. She's just a wonderful, wonderful woman who has helped me grow in Alcoholics Anonymous and understanding and effectiveness, and I'm extremely, extremely grateful for her. She's a wonderful woman. And I met her at that meeting, and we started going to meetings together. She did a meeting up at the Hampshire House of Correction, and a bunch of us would get in her car, and we'd drive up to the Hampshire House of Correction, and there was a woman, Connie, up at the Hampshire House of Correction that allowed my brother Pete to come in there and start carrying the message. And my brother Pete brought me up and sat me down with Connie, and she said, yeah, I think we'll allow him to come in. See, I wasn't supposed to be able to go in there. I was still on parole. And I started going in, and I started listening, and I sat down front, and I would just keep my mouth shut and watch as they ran the meetings. And I started meeting guys I knew, and they say, hey, Mark, when'd you get back? How long are you back for? And I say, hey, I'm here for a meeting of AA. I'm going home to watch Monday Night Football after this. You know, and started sharing with the guys and started enjoying life is what I started doing for the first time in my life. I got involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got involved in corrections work very early on. Donnie led me into the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and I found out that I lacked power. I lacked the power not to drink. And what he did was he led me into that book, and I found out that lack of power was my dilemma. I had to find a power by which I could live. Where was I going to find that power? Well, me, I found it in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Because, see, the 12th step tells me having had a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. And that's my experience. That's where I found God. I found God here in you and eventually in me. And I can remember I was sober about 4 or 5 months, and I had pneumonia that year and a half. I came to AA, and then I had pneumonia again, and I thought I had HIV, and I went up to the UMass Medical Center to get tested because I had done a lot of nasty things with a lot of nasty people in a lot of nasty places, and I got tested, and I went back the following week to get the results, and the nurse saw me, and she said, "Oh, Mark, we have a problem." And my heart fell to my stomach. I said, "Oh, no, I've got it." First thing I could picture was the great big funeral, like Tim talked about, and all that stuff, and AA hero dies, and, you know, the egomaniac that I am, you know. And the nurse came back in. She said, no, Mark, the machine broke. You got to come back next week. And I said, thank you. I ran to the Wednesday night step meeting, and I told Donnie what had happened. And he looked at me, and he saw the opening, and we walked into the back room, and we were just at that part of the book. And we get on our knees and said a third step prayer together. And then he opened the book, and what does it say? Next, we launch in a vigorous course of action. And I did the personal house cleaning that's outlined in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was able to look at myself for the first time in my life. See, it's not that three columns that's in there. You got to turn that page, and when you turn that page, that's when you get into the nitty-gritty. And that's where it happened for me. That beautiful thing started to happen. Donnie came up, and I shared that with him. I shared everything with him, even the stuff I thought I was going to take to the grave. And my life opened up. You know, my life opened up. I went home and I did 6 and 7, and I started becoming useful. I started doing my own meeting up at the Hampshire House of Correction, and then went on to the Connecticut State Prison and the Massachusetts State Prison. And I wound up going to court after being in Alcoholics Anonymous a year, and I was supposed to go back to prison. There was no doubt I was going back to prison. The judge looked down at me and he said, "You're doing some things to improve yourself. I'm going to give you 6 months without a finding." And I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was happy, joyous, and free, and I was good. I was good. But see, I was also dying inside of Alcoholics Anonymous because some things were troubling me on the inside that I could not make haste or waste of. And my buddy Don Pritz from Aurora, Colorado, who passed on this past year, was brought into my life, and he showed me a way out. And see, I was dying. I had some stuff going on inside my head that went on in Vietnam that I was unable to talk about. I was unable to see. It was unclear to me. It happened during the night when I was trying to sleep, and it was killing me. It was killing me. I was suicidal, and I was dying. I was dying inside of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wanted to die. I was doing everything that Alcoholics Anonymous suggests, but I was just unable to get to that. It just didn't open up for me. And what happened is my friend DeHolte, who was a friend at the time, we wound up going out to Angel Fire, New Mexico, to a DAV memorial out there. And it's up in Angel Fire, New Mexico. And it was started by a Dr. Westfall, whose son was in the first cab, the same outfit I was with, and he died in Vietnam. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful memorial. And I went out to that memorial, and I laid down some medals, and I said some prayers, and I let some stuff go, basically 6 and 7, and I walked out of there a free man. I went home that night, my head hit the pillow, and I had the first night's sleep I had ever had. First night's sleep I had ever had since I was a young boy, 18 years old. My life changed. Once again, how can I not come here when asked to? God has blessed me in so, so many ways. God is wonderful. God is beautiful. God has given me a life today that is second to none. Wow. Came back. DeHolte and I became friends. DeHolte was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. We were friends. We had a good time in AA. We went to meetings. She was living with a guy, and I'd see her, and she'd be all bruised up sometimes. And I'd say, "Hey, DeHolte, what's going on? How'd you get that bruise?" And she said, "Oh, well, I slipped the other night on the ice, or I fell down." I said, "Heck, I've been drunk all over the country, slipping on ice everywhere, and I ain't never got bruised up like that. What's really going on?" And a period of time later, she told me that the guy she was living with was abusing her. And I said, "Well, just leave him." And she said, "No, I can't do that. He threatened to kill my kids and my mother." And I said, "Well, go to the police." And she said, "No, I can't do that." And I just said, "Well, that's the way it is." And this guy was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, ladies, so don't always believe what you hear here. Check it out. And, you know, one day I rode down to the local coffee shop and I said, "Hey, Frank, let's take a ride." And Frank made the mistake of getting in the car. And we took a ride and old Frank disappeared. I didn't see him till about 2 years later. I didn't kill him. May have verbally abused him a taste, but what can I say? That's the way it was. I got to be honest up here. Old Frank disappeared, and a period of time later, Dalton and I became friends, and that friendship caught fire. And 5-6 years of sobriety, I took Dalton up in front of that psychiatric ward I was on, Ward 8, up at the Northampton VA hospital in the 1966 Dodge Dart, got out, opened the trunk, got a dozen roses, got on my knees and said, "Honey, will you marry me?" And what a backdrop. There was a full moon. The guys were in the windows howling. And, I mean, it was just, it was amazing. It was amazing, you know. And I asked her to marry me, and she said, "Yeah, when?" And I said, "Next month we'll go out to the second American Indian AA convention in Las Vegas, Nevada. My wife is Cherokee." And we did that following month. We went out to the second American Indian AA convention. We went out to a little place called Overton, Nevada to get married. And I went to the police chief and said, "Hey, is there someone in town that can marry us?" He said, "No, but the florist might know someone." And I went over and saw the florist. And she said, "Oh, my bishop would love to." Now, I'm brought up Catholic, and there's a bishop in this little town. What a score, you know. I hit the big time, and I went over. It was a Mormon bishop, and the Mormon bishop and his son married us under a beautiful tree, and we went back and skinny-dipped in Lake Mead and went back to the convention that night, and an Apache holy man stood up and blessed our wedding, our union, and a bunch of sober Indians honored us. And Saturday night after the speaker meeting, they had a big powwow, and all the Indians were out there in their Indian regalia, and I had my Italian outfit on. And they had a veterans dance, and they asked me to dance, and my wife pushed me out there, and I went out and danced with them. And I had my purple silk suit, my gold chains, my white silk shirt, and my black patent leather shoes on, and get out there and dance with them. And isn't God beautiful? Where else could this happen? You know, Alcoholics Anonymous, what a blessing it is to be here, isn't it? Golly. 2 days later, we flew into a little mesa in the Grand Canyon. Had this driver drive us around the rim of the mesa, and I'm looking over the side down into the canyon. Everybody else is, And it was just a wicked adrenaline rush. I got off the bus. I ran over to thank him. I looked down at his belt buckle. He had a first cab patch on his belt buckle. I said, "You were with the cab?" He said, "Yeah, I was with the cab, 67, 68, and now." I said, "God, I was there. I was with the 1st of the 7th B Company." He said, "I was with the 1st of the 7th C Company." We had been involved in a lot of the battles, knew some of the same people, but you didn't get close to very many people. We cried and hugged each other that day, and it was amazing. It was amazing. Just a beautiful, beautiful thing. The healing takes place as we go along. I met a man along this time, and his name was Don P., like I told you, from Aurora, Colorado, and very instrumental in my sobriety and in my life, and he taught me this is not an intellectual exercise, it's a spiritual journey, and I love that man. He taught me some beautiful things about myself. And, you know, my life just kept evolving. A short period of time, my wife and I moved to Navarre, Florida. Beautiful place. That's a beautiful place. Just a beautiful place. And
okay, Mark.
I looked down at Chris and he's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous that I met. It's been a tremendous power of example in my life and a tremendous growing experiences we've shared together. And I got to Florida and started going to meetings, and went to a meeting in a treatment center and looked across the room, and there was a Vietnamese kid sitting there. And I went over and talked to him after the meeting. My wife was with me, and gave him my phone number and asked him to call me, and went back the next week, and he didn't call. And I shared a little bit about my experience, strength, and hope. And I went back the next week and shared a little more, and he wasn't there. He called me a week later and asked me to be his sponsor. And Chung was in Vietnam while I was there doing my thing, and what he did was he shared his life with me through the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and told him how what had happened in his country, and how he had lost family members, and how resentful he was for so many years, and how he drank at this country. And we sat there, and we cried together, and a tremendous healing took place. And I got involved with the Miracle Group, and I started going up to the Okaloosa Correctional Institute and started doing things in Alcoholics Anonymous. And just, it's been a blessing, such a blessing. I met Chris, and Chris was, well, I got to tell you, before I met Chris, I was sponsoring a couple of guys, one named Don and the other one was named Ron. And Ron was a guy that couldn't get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. He was in the Air Force at the time. And Donnie was in and out. And I went down to pick up Don that night and take him to a meeting. And he was in the house yelling at someone on the phone. And Ron and my wife are sitting out in the car. And Ron come up to the door. And I knocked again. And I said, oh, he must have had a hard day. Something's going on. And Ron was standing beside me. And Donnie whipped the door open. And he had one of those big cell phones in his hand. And he took a swing at me and tried to hit me. And I ducked, and I lost it. I come up, and I hit him right in the midsection. I picked him up over my head, and I threw him. Sailed across the room. Boom, he hit the wall. He slid down the wall. I went in, and I dribbled him around the little trailer for a few minutes. And then I had him up in a full Nelson. I was getting ready to snap his neck. And I intuitively knew how to handle a situation that used to baffle me. I put him down, he scurried out the door. And a couple of days later, he went back to jail, and he was Chris's roommate up at the Okaloosa Correctional Institute. Chris was sitting in there trying to write an inventory, and God works in such mysterious ways, it just blows me away. And Donnie and him started talking, and Chris said, when I get out of here, I'm going to ask Mark B. to be my sponsor. He's on the corrections pamphlet. And Donnie said, don't ask him, man. That guy's crazy. He said, I got drunk last week, and he came over and beat the hell out of me. Chris said, that's the guy for me, man. And this journey with me and Chris started, and it's just been a tremendous, tremendous journey. Ron stayed sober. He's about 7 years sober now. He's in the Air Force. He's up in Iceland. I stayed sober. I went to a meeting of alcoholics that night. I called my sponsor, and I talked about what had happened. I talked about what had happened. And I continued on in the steps. I have a relationship with my father today. My father lives in Fort Walton Beach. He was on the news offering a reward for my capture. We broke my brother Pete out of jail, and he offered a reward for my capture early on. That was before I got sober, mind you. And, you know, this whole thing has just been an amazing, amazing journey. Right now, my wife and I are in the process of moving to New Mexico. We're moving out to Truth to Consequences, New Mexico, some health things and some other stuff, and I'm going to be leaving leaving these guys. And you know, I take this with me wherever I go. Alcoholics Anonymous is such a beautiful, beautiful deal. It has touched my heart. My brother Pete, after a number of years in Alcoholics Anonymous, picked up a drink. And he's back in prison for the rest of his life. That's why I cherish every second I have in Alcoholics Anonymous. Don Pritz taught me that I have to live in the moment. I have to live in the here and now. And it's okay to cry. It's okay to be alive. It's okay to enjoy life. Because I never knew that before I got here. I hated myself. I got grandkids today. Never been married, but have grandkids that love me. And there's been a lot of talk about grandkids. Let me read this to you. This is from my granddaughter, Sophie. I had to rescue Sophie. Her mother was involved in an abusive relationship, and I went up and moved them out of the house, and they came to Florida and lived with us for a while. Then they met her mother met a wonderful guy in the Air Force, and now they're over in Louisiana. And she's just the apple of my eye, and my grandson Josh is just a tremendous little kid, I was talking to him about a month ago, and we were talking and going back and forth at each other over the phone, and we were talking, and he said, "Hey, Pop Pop," and I said, "Yeah, what, Josh?" He said, "Eat my shorts." And I said, "Josh, where'd you get that, man?" He said, "On TV." He said, "You airplane head." And just, I have such a great time with these kids. And after my granddaughter Sophie left, she wrote this little thing to me, and it's truly, I mean, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. It says, "Dear Pop-Pop, I am having a great time. I hope you are too. I love you, and I will come again next year, I promise. I will miss you when I leave on Saturday, but I will call you as soon as I get home. I really like spending time with you at the beach. I appreciate that you played with me. I hope I wasn't any trouble. Your granddaughter, Sophie." You know? And those are the gifts that we receive in Alcoholics Anonymous, the friendships that we receive in Alcoholics Anonymous. These two guys, I know Chris better than anyone, and Chris knows me better than anyone. Why? Because we sat down and did the program of recovery as outlined in this book and shared our innermost secrets with each other. He's the son I never had. And I'll forever be grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous for that and all the beautiful gifts it's given me. What a blessing it is to be here. And you're in for such a treat. Tonight Liz is going to share. And I met Liz in Minnesota 6 years ago, and I had heard her talks before and just never had the opportunity to meet her. And my wife and I were able to sit down with her for a while and truly talk, and it was just a beautiful thing to be a part of. And last night I met Tim and Chuck that spoke today. He missed AA by the phenomenon of craving, like he says, about a half a nip, man. And then tomorrow, let me tell you, you're in for a treat tomorrow, because I know Bob's sponsor, and I love Bob's sponsor, and he moved on to the big meeting, and I know we're all in for a treat tomorrow, because I've heard him share just over tape, but so looking forward to hear him share face to face. And what a blessing. Does God love us or what? Does God love us or what? Man, Alcoholics Anonymous is the best thing that's ever happened to me, and I hope for you. Thank you.